Good evening. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder. Welcome to Mind Over Matter, a monthly K2 radio show that explores issues of the heart as well as of the mind and body. Tonight, we will be having a conversation about wellness, weight, and lifestyle changes. We'll explore the cultural, the psychological, the physiological, and even the political aspects of a common dilemma for many Americans, being overweight or obese, as well as the many health problems that come along with being overweight. Americans love fad diets. Sometimes it's low fat or no carbs. Right now, the buzz is about gluten-free. I've even seen labels on ordinary food, such as dried apricots, announcing that they are gluten-free, as if just labeling something that we know has no gluten in it makes it a healthy choice. I'd say it makes it a corporate healthy choice or a profitable choice. This evening, we'll look at both nutritional science, social science, and social science to understand why Americans as a population are the most overweight people in the world. But more importantly, we'll see what we can do about our own struggle with weight, if we have one. I'd like to introduce our guest for this evening, Sarah Lewis, who is currently teaching a year-long program called Health Matters at Bartlett Hospital.
I am.
Yeah. Welcome, Sarah.
Thank you so much, Elaine.
Now, how did you get – Sarah, I have to tell you, was a little tiny person, sort of. Okay. So how did you get involved with this Bartlett program that is a year-long program?
Yes.
And how did you get involved teaching it?
So – want me to start from the beginning?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So I am a cooperative extension agent for the University of Alaska Fairbanks. So that's my job. And what the cooperative extension does is we are basically the community education arm of, and we're in every state, we're the community education arm of the land-grant university in that state. So that's why I'm an employee of UAF in Fairbanks. But I'm down here teaching, and what we do at Cooperative Extension is we both learn what is being done in research, in institutions, in universities, and we put together programs that are based on basically life skills of different types, whether it's gardening. People are probably familiar with Master Gardener and 4-H and things like that. I do a lot of the food-related stuff, so food preservation, et cetera. So what we do is we create programs based on scientific information, research, et cetera, that we give to the general public. But we also go the other way. We learn what people are wanting to gain skills in, and we create programs. This is a really interesting program, the Health Matters program. I was actually a participant in it. I took the class.
How long ago?
Just last year. So last January, and I just finished up in December. I did that personally. And about halfway through, they said, you know, we always have a waiting list. We really need to add some more classes. We need to add another series, another year. And one of the things we do in extension is we fill gaps. And boy, how did that seem like a gap that needed to be filled was teaching this very important diabetes prevention program series that goes over the course of the year. So that's how I became a coach. It's because it's designed specifically, and it was actually designed by a cooperative extension program in Pittsburgh. And so that was another thing. I didn't know that until I started taking the class. And I went, oh, this is actually an extension program. We actually have a trainer up north. Up in Fairbanks. One of the people that's in my program up north, Leslie Shallcross. She is also a trainer. And it was just a perfect fit, especially since it's designed so that the coaches are not in the medical professions. They're not dietitians or nutritionists. It really is designed to be peer-led.
Mm-hmm.
And there I was, a peer.
Well, you're a very professionally trained peer.
So it was a good match.
For full disclosure, I am in the middle of the program. And the reason I know about it is because I signed up for the program in order to lose weight, mm-hmm. in order to be healthier.
Yes.
And I frankly thought that Sarah was so knowledgeable about really a whole bunch of aspects about why we eat, what we eat, how much we eat. And this includes social and
yes.
cultural cues.
It does.
It's been, I just say, a most evidence-based program I could imagine. And I thought that it was so worthwhile that I wanted to share it with my listeners.
It is. It's a really beneficial program in that way because it is evidence-based. And that's one of the main tenets of Extension, is that things do need to be evidence-based.
And to explain what that means, it simply means the science is there. So
yes.
a lot of food fads, okay, including gluten-free and interesting, I wanted to make sure that I really knew what I was talking about. So while I was preparing for this program, I did some research on gluten-free and what pops up but the Texas Extension mm-hmm. Program. And it's all about gluten-free and how that's absolutely important if you have celiac disease
yes. mm-hmm.
or are highly sensitive to gluten, which would be just a small, small percentage of the population. And they also went on, and it reminded me of a Mother Jones article I read about gluten-free program. It is a corporate exercise in creating a product that can make a lot of money. But there's no evidence at all that being gluten-free is particularly good for you.
No, yeah, for the general public. And that's a very interesting point because a lot of what we do in our, you'll hear me say big D diets, you know, the diets that are very planned diets and something that you're following like the Atkins or something like that, as opposed to a little D diet, which is what you eat, your eating patterns. The human diet would be just a little D diet because that can get confusing. But the one of the main things that happens is the reductionist tendency to be focusing on either one of the macronutrients, which is, you know, fat, carbs, protein, or focusing too much on, you know, a micronutrient, you know, putting too much stock in vitamin C, putting too much stock. And what we really need to do and what the Health Matters program focuses on is the evidence actually shows that it's kind of what we really do all know about a good, healthy, well-rounded diet that is higher in vegetables and fruit, so higher in plant-based foods, and lower in animal-based foods. Lower in fat, but not a low-fat diet. The Health Matters program is not a low-fat diet. It is a lower-fat diet, but a lot of that has to do with as soon as you start increasing your vegetable and your plant-based dietary intake, you are going to be lowering a lot of that fat. And we work a lot because there are different metrics that you can use. There's calories. Mm-hmm. You know, how many calories do you have? And that's really an easy one. And as you know, Elaine, we start out with that one. We start by counting calories and then we start like, oh, which is terrible.
Because I don't like going on internet and I got a book
yes.
with all these calories. And I swear, in the beginning,
it's very hard.
Well, in the beginning, it would take forever
mm-hmm.
because I just didn't want to be sitting in front of the screen all the time.
Right.
But I do want to say something about that. Magic in this madness of counting calories. And what's so obvious after, and you don't count, this is a year-long program, but you don't count calories
no,
for
not
a
the
year.
Whole time. It's just how
okay,
we start.
No.
Yep.
So what was so obvious to me after, I mean, I had to count the calories, I had to pay the price and spend the time doing that, was would I rather have a piece of chocolate fudge and be hungry, really hungry, or would I like to be very satisfied? And I do have to tell you, I really like broccoli, so this is okay. Or a plate half filled with broccoli and reduce the noodles. I'm a pasta lover
mm-hmm.
too. So let's say instead of chocolate, it's like a big portion of pasta. And So what I figured out, obviously, is I could keep under my range of what was allowable if I still wanted to lose weight and be totally full and eating lots of
greens.
Eating
the things you like. Yeah.
So you that's what happens.
Right. Yeah.
You change then. You automatically
change.
You do.
It's a great program in that because it is 22 classes over the course of the year. So at first we start out every week and then we move into biweekly and then eventually monthly. Because we're going through so many different steps that, you know, starting with just the calorie counting and then adding in exercise, because we, of course, those are the two main things of the program are better eating and more exercise. And
I'm sure people out there are going, well, yeah. Yeah,
well, yeah. And that is, I mean, it's another one of those things. But
there's magic in it.
There's some magic we'll talk about this, in group classes.
Yeah.
There's magic in having a prescribed program to follow.
Yep.
But this is a prescribed program that is actually based on you finding your own way. It's a map of how you can find your own way through this, rather than specifically you need to eat this in the morning and this at noon and you need to, you know, go entirely protein-based, you know, all kinds of different
big D diets. For my friends who know I'm doing this program, one person said, oh, what supplements are you taking?
Right.
I said, none, because none are necessary. That's another big business of supplements. And then the other said, well, you're not eating carbs. Is it, you know, you're low carbs? I said, no, but it kind of works out that I will have more broccoli than pasta.
Right. It's fascinating. People really do, over the course of about the first 6 months, really do figure out on their own to a certain extent that, yes, that, you know, filling 3/4 of your plate with plant-based foods gets the calories, gets the satisfaction. You don't need to have the double portion of meat that you always thought you needed to. You don't need to have the double portion of the carb. You actually sort of start to balance your plate out. And we just start very simply and move through the program. And this is the first time that I have taught this program, that I've led it.
You would know it.
I took it. So that's definitely an in. You know, that gave me a lot of insight into the program because I did it myself, which is actually a really, really helpful thing in being a coach for it, because I do know about the difficulties of those first couple weeks of how do you track your food, all those things, what app do you use if you wish to do that, if you don't want to use an app, you know, and so on and so forth. And then I know about the 6 months through, something will kind of happen where you realize that you can be a little more creative because you really do start to know your food and you start to know how much of this and that you can eat. You become much more mindful. We talk about that, of course. You pay more attention. And the attention is important.
And what I've done, because I started in August and now we're in January, so I am not counting calories right now, but I have a sense of what they are.
Right.
And so what I've discovered that is working for me right now is I still write down all my food that I eat. Why? It's kind of like the piece of paper has me really acknowledge. Like I was at a party last night and I just kept eating nuts. Mm-hmm. Now, you know, actually Sarah had given me some feedback that I should up my non-meat. Yep. We're a subsistence family with tons of fish and meat. And so, you know, the hors d'oeuvres were very high kale, except for the nuts. And but I had to write them down. And I had to say, that was a lot of nuts. And I'm going to guess I ate 3/4 of a cup of nuts. Mm-hmm. So it's that mindless eating that I know I can't do because I'm going to write it down.
Yeah.
So, I don't want to keep having to do this the rest of my life, but I may have to. I don't know.
But that gets to what you just talked about there, gets to a couple of different points. So there's the mindfulness of it, the paying attention to what you're doing. There's also, and I try to infuse a little bit of stuff about behavior change, about habit forming and habit changing into the class, not necessarily into the content of the class as much as recognizing the different ways that people will respond to expectations, whether they're your internal expectations or whether you respond better to external expectations. And I think about in each one of the classes, each one of the weekly or biweekly classes, how can I best reach the different types of the personalities that are in the group and how it will best be able to be understood by them and actually they want to meet that expectation.
Could you unpack that by
Sure.
talking about the different personality types?
Right.
And also some of the tricks of the trade, meaning I remember one, which I have done, which is on your counter, keep low fat or not low fat, keep healthy snacks, keep fruit
right.
out.
Fruit. A
keep
bowl of fruit.
Keep fruit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so keep fruit out. So I like these little tangerines.
Yes.
I eat a lot of those
yes.
little tangerines because
mm-hmm.
I'll get really hungry. And back in the old days, before the program, I would just like be ravenous. But dinner wasn't going to happen till 7, and I'm ravenous. And I'd go in and cut a slice of brie
yep.
and put it on a couple of crackers.
And
yep. I don't do that now.
Mm-hmm.
Go
right.
through the personality
right,
types.
Right, so that's there's two different things there that I really like to that I've I it, there's enough leeway in the program that I can kind of include these things, even though it is a very prescriptive program. So one is so I have done a bit of research. There's a researcher named Gretchen Rubin, who a lot of work of hers I've read. She's a researcher. She is not a scientist, which is interesting. And so I tend to, it's not something that I'm necessarily going to teach specifically in the class because I'm not sure how research-based it is. But as a teacher of adults, I have found it to be very helpful. And it has to do with how you respond to or choose not to respond to expectations. So external hmm. expectations and internal expectations hmm. are kind of the two categories. And most of the folks in most of the classes that I'm going to teach actually will respond well, if not best, to having external expectations put on them. They want to oblige other people. They want to show that they can do it. They want to live up to other people's expectations. And that's why these group classes can be really good, because we have logging. And I read your logs.
Oh. As a person who went to school most of her life, it seems, I am very, when I turn in my homework
yes.
assignment, you better read it. And I want a grade.
And so I do the best I can of giving feedback. And so knowing that someone is going to be reading and paying attention to what you're doing, there are weigh-ins at every single one of the classes. That is another sort of external, potentially an external expectation
yeah.
that you actually see on that chart that there is a goal of losing. It's only 7% of the weight that you start the program with. That's it. 7%.
Which is really clever because
it's great.
We all want to lose
most,
a lot.
Most people have personal goals that are
yeah,
greater than that.
Greater than that. But because that's the program goal, which doesn't mean you can't go beyond it,
right.
you get an A in
yes.
your brain
yes,
if you,
do. You
lose 7%. And,
right.
you know, that has a sense of, well, that's not so much. It doesn't. It is, let me tell you. It's not easy. And then the weigh-in, of course, which is completely private. And
right.
Sarah doesn't do the weigh-in, and a hospital staff person does.
Right.
But she's completely poker-faced.
Oh,
because
yes.
she – so it's mm-hmm. kind of funny because you
want
her to
say – which is good for her to do it because
yeah, well,
I'm not always.
To be. Well, she has to be. But it's all – it's funny because the games – I don't know what other people play in their heads.
Right.
But I kind of cram for the exam.
Right.
And so about 2 or 3 days – because now we're meeting only every 2 weeks. We used to meet every week, and now we meet only every 2 weeks. So a couple of days before the class, I am on best behavior.
Yes.
Because I want – I'm externalizing
yes.
this to
right.
her, And she's going to see what I did, even though she could care less.
Right, exactly. Well, no, I know that is not true.
Oh,
I care
she cares.
Lot. I
she
care.
Oh,
I,
you care.
Oh, yes. And actually, she does as well. But it is actually interesting that you say that, because when I do the weigh-ins, it's really hard for me not to go, woohoo.
I know.
Or oh, don't worry. No, don't worry.
But
it's
you know,
okay.
It's confidential,
but
so you really
is,
can't
yeah,
do
so
that.
It is, yeah. So I try very hard. But I do see them, of course, because they're all on the table that, you know, that we have to keep track
yeah.
of. And
uh-huh.
and so I know where people are and what their progress or lack thereof and things like that. So that's one really great way that I am able to sort of meet a certain learning type in a habit forming or habit changing strategy that helps a lot of people, which is
so
the outside expectations.
So expectations
right.
outside.
And so Gretchen Rubin calls folks that really do respond best to outside expectation obligers.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what you kind of do. You feel the need to oblige other folks. Aren't necessarily as good at meeting inner expectations. So making a goal for yourself internally that doesn't have some sort of external check on it is harder for a lot of folks who are very focused on obliging others. And this is a pretty typical thing. Then there are the folks who are both. You know, we know folks like that who both meet external expectations and internal expectations. They're really pretty go-getter, things like that. And so those folks also do well with the external expectations aspects of being in a group class. But also once we get to the end of that 6 months where we're really checking in a lot and we move to the less frequent classes, those people are if they have really solidified the concepts of the program, they're really kind of able to be a self-coach because they've internalized it and they actually do follow their internal expectations. And then there's folks who that particular group where you meet both external and internal, she calls upholders. They uphold whatever expectations are being put upon them, internal, external. Another category is questioners. And this is actually a really interesting group to me because these are folks who really do need to hear why, and it needs to be a good reason. And that's one of the reasons I love Extension, because we do make a big point. And Bartlett, you know, this whole Bartlett program, that they are the ones that chose this program.
Right.
Because it is a really positive and evidence-based program. And there are folks, that is one of the things they need. They need to know why are we, you know, it's a pain to count our calories and it's a pain to log all of our food. Why? And so I try to make a point in every class, and they do in the program materials. They really do try to make a point of letting you know why. What's the research behind this that makes this effective for people?
And also the research on are there particular foods you can eat,
right.
calories aside?
Right.
Because there's a real belief system in our culture
mm-hmm.
that if you eat, if you eliminate certain foods from your diet,
right.
there's some kind of magic. I know that I was on, I think it was called the Stillman diet.
Mm-hmm.
This was like 40 years ago. And we ate meat or something. We ate a lot of protein.
Right.
And, it's all part of that historical fad trend where there's always going to be some bad food.
Right.
That you must eliminate.
Right. There's either a silver bullet or the evil or whatever.
Yeah.
And one thing that I do need to, and I probably should have done this at the very beginning, I am neither a dietitian nor a nutritionist, so I'm not certified formally
mm-hmm.
or certified in those. I have taken classes through Extension, through Cornell that have to do with plant-based eating plans and diets and things like that. And so that's where when I get questions like that, especially when we're talking about folks who are in a class because they have been either diagnosed or have had other aspects of their health that show that they're heading towards what's called prediabetes.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people in the class are there for medical reasons.
And I do want to add that Sarah is highly credentialed in some
related
fields.
Related
she
fields,
has a master's
yes.
of social work
I
degree.
Do, yes.
And she is a trained architect.
Yes, I'm a licensed architect.
Licensed architect.
Ooh, you had to take all those tests.
Yeah.
Get credit
okay.
for them.
Well, good for you.
But yeah, so it's important to me, especially when people ask about specific macronutrients or micronutrients or categories of, food, meat or plant or things like that. That this program really is about a very rounded diet. And if there are very specific needs that people have, whether that's been figured out by, a medical professional, or if they think they do because they've done some self-diagnosis, that kind of thing, I really do like to forward on to, a clinical dietitian. And that's part of the reason why Cynthia Nickerson is actually involved in the class. Mm. She's the one that comes and does weigh-ins,
right.
and I check in
right.
with her because she is the diabetes education director for Bartlett. And so she has a lot of, obviously, training and knowledge,
yeah.
et cetera. And so, but that's one of the points of the class is that it is not medically based because sustainability, being able to sustain this program for yourself, part one of the problems with a lot of diets that may have benefits to them tend to have shorter term, if not short term benefits, because you can't sustain them.
Yeah.
Because they're not actually potentially not reasonable for your life.
Right.
For your lifestyle, for your patterns. They're potentially good for short term. And one of the goals of this program is that it is good for the long term. And so that's why we spread the class out over a year,
which
I think is especially important in Juneau because we're dealing with seasons.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with how do you exercise in different seasons? How do you eat in different seasons? Things like that. And so having it go over a course of a year, there's lots of different challenges that come up. And so questioners are folks who really do need to know why before they're going to buy in. And then they internalize it and they will potentially proceed,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. more effectively. And then there are folks who Gretchen Rubin calls rebels, and they resist all expectations. And they sound, at first you go like, oh, that's the awful group. But it really isn't necessarily. What they want is the freedom to choose. And that's another thing that I really like about this program, because even though, yes, it is a prescribed program, it's in such small bits that you're never sort of told, this is exactly what you have to do or else. It's here's the framework, and now you get to choose what vegetables. We're not going to.
Or how you fill your 40 minutes or 60 minutes
right,
of
exercise.
Weekly exercise.
Exactly.
Whatever.
So 150
minutes.
You don't even know that because you always surpass that every week. I happen to know from your logs. But 150 minutes for some folks
yeah.
is a real goal that they need to work up towards.
Right.
And how do you. How you do that is very much up to you. And so I just give as much information as possible so that folks who kind of need to create their own expectations, whether it's internal or external, that those folks have enough to grab onto that they can make their own decision and they can have the freedom to make the program their own. So that's one of the things that when I was taking the program, being a person who's in adult education and paying attention to these different skills and tendencies is what she calls them. These are not personalities. These are tendencies that we have. I tend to be an obliger, for example. I like to make other people happy. So knowing that about myself is actually pretty important. And it's really nice to know that that's possible in my class as well. It's not therapeutic. I am a social worker, but I'm not working as a clinical social worker in this particular capacity, nor would I want to, because this is not that. This is not a therapeutic setting. This is a lifestyle setting. It's a lifestyle change and habit forming setting.
Okay. Hey, I have an idea.
Yes.
Let's take a short musical break now, and then Sarah Lewis and I will be back to talk some more about a relatively fascinating approach to a healthier life that includes exercise and diet, and we'll be right back. Mind Over Matter. I'm Dr. Elaine Schroeder, and with me tonight in the studio is Sarah Lewis, who has been teaching a course entitled Health Matters at Bartlett Hospital. So far, we've been discussing issues around weight loss, describing the class that she's teaching, and we're going to talk about some of the forces in our society that contribute to Americans being significantly more overweight than their peers in other countries. Some of the behavioral or psychological aspects.
Yes, and cultural, right?
And cultural of why Americans, at least some of us, eat so much and so poorly. Okay, yeah. So Sarah.
Go.
Go.
you and I,
we had been talking earlier about cultural differences.
Yes.
I've lived in France for a long time. Mm-hmm. Sarah recently visited Japan. Mm-hmm. And yep. We came up with some interesting observations.
We did. And one thing that's very interesting to me is how we in America are taught that in all kinds of aspects of our lives, more is better. And
literal consumerism.
Yes,
we're going to consume.
Is consume
really?
More. And that does, as we're talking about, that does move into our food as well for different reasons. We, we can go into all kinds of things, but land of plenty and really there's some latent potential fears of not having enough. And so from different generations. So there are generational differences in terms of the relationship with food and portion sizing. But there's also political stuff that and PR wars that go on related to portion sizing, because they actually do, when you go back to the foundations of them, many of them do have to do with our farming practices and the promotion of different individual ingredients and making sure that those the lobby, agriculture lobbies of various products are really, you know, doing their best for those industries. And sometimes that isn't necessarily the best thing for food consumers. Those aren't necessarily the ingredients. I mean, the really obvious one that, of course, you know, is sugar.
Yeah.
Sugar is really a big one.
In the sense of the sugar lobby?
Yes. Uh-huh. Yes. And the amount that we put in our food, and those are related. There is a lot of research done about why that works so well for us, because we are, as humans, wired towards sweet in general. And so it's not difficult to get us more and more desensitized to sweeter and sweeter and sweeter and sweeter and sweeter, because we do have that tendency anyways. Whereas that's not something that necessarily happens in other countries, because they aren't trying to use up a lot of sugar and finding more places to put different types of sugar and create things to do with all the different parts of corn, you know, which
yes.
also includes sugar. And so when you add all of those factors in, it's a perfect storm of making it extremely difficult for the American public to know what to eat, especially when you then add in socioeconomic factors, because we have made some foods so inexpensive because they are subsidized.
And like what?
Like things with sugar in them, like processed foods.
Processed?
Yes. Well, the grain industry and there's lots of agricultural industries that are subsidized to make sure that they remain strong. And so when there's a lot of them, then they need to put it in more and more types of food. And that food ends up being cheaper than it actually is to produce. So that's why a locally made and baked loaf of bread is considerably more expensive, potentially, than a loaf that was made in a factory a ways away but then got shipped up here. Even though you've got to add in all of that transportation, et cetera, it's still going to be less expensive, and it may be subsidized by various nutrition programs, food, the family nutrition programs where you actually, like food stamps and things like that. It might actually be certain things are subsidized that way as well. And so what that starts to do is we don't have anymore in a lot of families and communities a very good picture of what a truly healthy diet is, because we have been the advertising and what is made available to us
And the lobbying.
Yes, is not necessarily going to be the things that we talk about in my class. In this class, I try to talk a lot about unprocessed foods, because that's where you're going to find the most nutrition. And whether that vegetable is frozen or canned or fresh, it's still nutritious. In fact, the frozen vegetable may be more nutritious because of the time it's been, the shorter time that it spent between the ground, the harvest, and the process, the deep freeze, which could in some cases be less than a day, is potentially more nutritious than the head of broccoli that's been shipped up here and is now 3 weeks old and is still nutritious. I do not want to say that's so we don't need to be afraid of frozen and canned, because a lot of times they keep a lot more nutrition because there is less time between harvest and processing. So helping people understand that the less the food is processed in general, the closer it is to what our bodies actually need.
And this brings up Michael Pollan.
Yeah,
and
it sure does.
Michael Pollan in The Carnivore's Dilemma.
Right.
My takeaway,
mostly plants, not too much.
My takeaway actually was don't eat, Avoid anything that your grandmother wouldn't recognize in the supermarket. This is assuming your grandmother is 100 years old, but because processed food came in, you know, when some grandmothers walking around like me, so it would be my great-grandmother. And basically, it's a way to say no processed food, no fake food.
Right, right.
I mean, just real food.
Real food. And that's what we really do need to work out, though, because, of course, there's lots of advertising. They try all – there's all kinds of different ways that our brains get tricked. And so that's actually a really interesting thing when it comes to, like, portion sizing and the amounts of food we eat. There's a book that I've talked about in class a fair bit called Slim by Design. Mm-hmm. And it is actually very evidence-based. It's by Brian Wansink, who is a PhD-level researcher. I believe he's still at Cornell. But I'm not sure, but at the Cornell Food Lab, where they actually do research about behavior around food and what behaviors we do that if we're not either not paying attention, so mindless eating, but as well as our environment. That's why it's called Slim by Design. And this is my architecture and my social work and my, you know, interest in food sort of all comes together mm-hmm. with this terrific book that I really recommend. But it talks about, like, for example, you brought up earlier, the trick, it's not that much of a trick, but of keeping a bowl of fruit mm-hmm. on your counter.
Yeah.
There is actual research to show that folks who the only food that you can see, the only edible food that you can see, if you're in your kitchen and you're looking around, if it's a bowl of fruit, on average, those folks will weigh less than folks who even just have cereal visible. Or a loaf of bread visible.
Uh-huh.
Or, of course, you know, not even talking about having, you know, a bowl of candy or chips or things like that. Yeah, that goes the next step.
Uh-huh.
Especially no snack foods.
Uh-huh.
But even things that we, you know, consider somewhat healthy, like bread. Even if it's whole wheat bread, it's still, if you've got that stuff visible and you actually have the toaster available right there, ready to go, you are more likely to be eating foods that are not going to be whole foods.
Right.
And are not going to be as helpful to you. And so just the simple trick of having a visible bowl of fruit and nothing else, no other food visible, having everything in cupboards is a simple one that actually has an effect. So there's lots of things like that.
More examples.
Yes, more examples. More examples is don't ever eat anything straight out of the bag. We are terrible. Humans are terrible at being able to visualize how much we just ate if it's not served out to us in a portion. Always serve it to yourself in a bowl, in a serving size. Or if you're going to do more than a serving, recognize that's what you're doing and just be aware of that.
So
that
buffets, might mean
buffets are difficult. And Brian Wansink it's the small plate movement. I love that. The small plate movement. So one of the things they figured out in buffets is that you actually want people to have smaller plates because they'll eat a little bit less. And so you want people to be spending more for less food.
And the plates they make nowadays,
mm-hmm.
is this correct? Are bigger than the plates that were made at the turn of the century.
Right.
So I have my parents' wedding china.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And the plates are somewhere between what we would call a half plate and
it's sort of like a salad plate.
Yeah, it's like a little bigger than a salad plate.
Yeah.
But they're really smaller, and it's a beautiful china set.
Yeah.
And this is the size of the plate. So when we say supersize me, we also are talking about we've supersized our plates.
We have.
And, as part of this program, one thing I've been wanting to do is use the smaller plates.
Yes. Right. I think that was one of the things that I put in one of my earlier emails is here's an assignment for the weekend. Go into your kitchen and do these different things. And one thing is reduce your plate size. Only use I think it's like a 9 or a 10 inch plate as opposed to our what has now become a standard 12 inch plate or larger. And so the way we can visualize that is a lot of times they do have those smaller plates at buffets, at all you can eat buffets. They will have the smaller plates. And so if you can kind of visualize that size, because there is psychology around having a full plate. You feel more satisfied if you ate from a plate that was full. And you cleaned your plate. But we've got the Clean Plate Club.
Yes.
Is another American thing.
Oh.
Is the Clean Plate Club, because we don't want to waste. We are not a wasteful nation. You know, there's all kinds of different
things. We're wasteful, but we
all
want to clean our plate.
We don't want to seem
wasteful.
And that's
part of the classic all-American family, which is clean your plate, eat every last bit that's on your plate.
And it's interesting because you mention a set of plates that you got from family. I also did. And my parents got married just shortly after they were living in Japan together. And they were given as a wedding gift a whole set of Japanese. It's Noritake, I think.
Yeah.
And everything is smaller. And that was even in the 60s almost, the mid 60s. And so everything is smaller. The cups, the coffee cups, everything is smaller. And so when I recently went to Japan, I wondered, since our plates used to be smaller, yes, their plates are still smaller whereas ours grew.
Speaking of Japan, we hosted a Japanese teacher. Her name is Chiseko for about a year on a exchange program she taught at Harborview. And it was pre-Costco. Still, it was post-Fred Meyer's. And, we have these gigantic supermarkets. What we would bring home, so we have two or three kids living at home. We have Chiseko and the dog and my husband and myself. So we would bring home huge amounts of food. And, if she had been around during Costco times, she would have fallen over. But occasionally she would make dinner. And our oldest son was a teenager then and was eating lots of food. And she would put dinner on the table, and he would, not minding his manners, say, "And what's for the rest of the meal?" Because it would be such small amounts.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
When my husband and I traveled in Japan when we were poor college students, we didn't have much money, and he's a big guy. My husband is tall, and we would go to noodle shops, and he would need to order twice as much. He would think he needed to order.
Right.
Twice as much as what was normally considered a serving. Now, let's jump over to France, where I've spent a lot of time. It's quality over quantity, which is definitely a Japanese deal. What you do is you have an exquisite preparation.
Oh,
One time we caught Chiseko cutting sesame seeds in half.
Oh.
It was taking quite a bit of time. But the idea that we would spend that much pay that much attention. And this really brings in mindfulness too. It brings it all in, which is, let's use Japan, two very different cultures, France and Japan. One definitely known for their cuisine, France. And the beauty of the presentation of the food.
The whole experience.
The whole experience.
The whole
sensory
experience.
I don't know what
experience.
The social experience is in Japan, but I can say, having lived in France for a couple of years, that over dinner, which would start probably at 8 o'clock at night and go till midnight, and I never could figure out how French people could live on 6 hours of sleep, but they did. They went to work the next day. But the dinner would go on forever. Not that you were eating tons of food.
Right.
Quite
Mm-mm.
the opposite. It was you were being nourished by the conversation.
Right.
And the conversation was often a conversation of ideas. And, the French are known for their love of philosophers and philosophy and so, and soirees and good conversation.
Mm-hmm.
So the combination of both the attention to detail, the relatively small portion size,
Focus on quality.
And the focus on quality and the fact that French people are much thinner than American. You can tell American tourists.
Yes.
You can spot them. Mm-hmm. And they're starting, I'm afraid it's seeping over into Canada, too, because, they're getting.
And apparently France as well. But they're sort of trying to nip it early.
I wonder if Japanese snack. We're big snackers.
They certainly. They have the most interesting snacks.
Yummy.
They have incredible snacks, but they're very small portions.
Yes.
Even the snacks are very small portions. We actually get a monthly box called Tokyo Treats, and it has a whole bunch of crazy Japanese snacks in it, and they've got so much less sugar. But
yeah.
They're tasty and they're fun and they're in little containers.
They're crispy,
you know,
little crispy.
Crispy little things, things that taste like shrimp.
Yeah.
You know, and as well as some really actually quite delicious sweet things, but they're not the level of sweetness that we are used to. And
yeah.
So it's fascinating. Yeah. Another
cultural difference between here and France is our tendency to eat on the run.
Yes.
And I'm as big an offender as anybody because I get like busy and I'm multitasking and I've eaten lunch when my husband's gone in front of the computer doing, mm-hmm. I mean, it's crazy. So I had a real funny experience when I was a college student in France. I was visiting a friend in the Paris suburbs and I was rushing and I got on a commuter train and I had an apple in my purse and I got the apple out and I'm eating the apple on the train. And she lived in a big high rise out in the suburbs, and they have different suburbs than we do. They have high rise suburbs, so it was a condo. And I knocked on her door, and she said, "Gosh, what took you so long to get here? I heard you were on the train, you know, from the station." And I said, "How'd you know I was on this train?" Because I hadn't told her what train I was coming on. And she said, "Oh, people saw you and told me you were coming." I said, "Well, how do they know I was coming to see you?" And she said, "Well, I told them an American friend was coming, and they saw you eating an apple on the train, and only an American would sit on the train eating an apple." And first of all, in Japan and France, you would cut up the apple.
Yes,
I'm doing the right. All-American thing of this great big apple, and
right.
I go crunch. And it was so culturally, of course, that was a long time ago.
Right.
So culturally bizarre.
Well, and it's not necessarily the eating on the run part either, because in Japan, they certainly do eat on the run.
Yeah.
There are the bento box shops in the train stations, and you're getting your bento box that you're going to be eating on the train.
Yeah.
And of course, I was only there for, you know, a week and a half, so I don't have a wide experience. But you're talking about a bento box, which one of the concepts that we came to learn about while we were there was the idea of eating, and I don't know the number, but I want to say it's something like try to eat at least 25 different foods a day. And we think, oh, that's not hard. But really, if you track what you're eating, we in America might get up to 12. Really, if you don't include all of the weird additives in, you know, various food, but of the real food ingredients. Whereas a bento box, you could have, you know, from 9 to 24 right there, and they're tiny little portions.
Little pickles.
And they're very vegetable-based, so there might be some seafood, so it's a lot of seafood and vegetable. And it's not a big sandwich with a whole, you know, that's half bread, and then, you know, then a quarter meat. And maybe if you're lucky, you know, a quarter vegetables with it. But so it's a very different mix of foods. And it's a mix of foods that is really what research shows is much closer to what we need for our health. That particular high vegetable and, you know, fruit and other and plant-based diet, minimal meats with certainly a focus on fish and seafood, at least where we were in Japan. And even, you know, so you and I've talked a little bit about, you know, Alaskan subsistence diets.
Yeah.
And so that's a really interesting one to me that I have no research that I have really looked into. But when I was studying plant-based nutrition, that was a real sticking point for me. That there seemed to be a fair amount of dogma that went along with research. And the dogma tended to be if mostly plant is good for you, then all plant, entirely plant, must be better. And it was a class in which I was able to have feedback. And I had to say to a couple of the professors that that is not going to be something that I'm ever going to tell, especially you know, my native communities that I work in, that their their subsistence lifestyle that they have been following for millennia is somehow now, and that the only vegetables they can get is an old cabbage, you know, in their grocery store. And they've, you know, until recently, because of outside factors coming in, obviously had a very healthy diet. So I, you know, that it's troubling to me, and it's not something that I've done enough research into to really sort of tease out some of those, you know, the scientific basis behind the Alaska Native diet. And
Yeah, it's interesting.
And so that's why I don't necessarily, like, one of the things that you do is you eat a lot of venison and fish because your freezer is full of it, and so is ours. And there are apparently, there is research to show that there is more, there's types of nutrition in beef, for example, or in wild grazing animals, meat animals, that makes that healthier for us. And so there's lots of different things with that that I even need to think about when I come closer to home when it comes to culture. And how to help when we're talking about diabetes prevention, because diabetes really is, it is, it's sweeping the nation, and it's especially sweeping communities, you know, here in Alaska, that it really is only recently that this, you know, sugar laden or and flour laden, not necessarily gluten isn't necessarily the issue there. It's a highly processed flour. That's very recent, and, you know, bodies are not designed for that.
So we need to
diabetes follows.
So with the classic American exceptionalism, we are exceptionally obese. And that, I guess, leads to the fact that we are exceptionally diabetic.
Yes.
And we are exceptionally at risk of heart disease.
Yes, the various metabolic, what they call it, metabolic
syndrome,
diseases of metabolic syndrome, whether it might be a specific one or you might have several. Often we have several. You've got your diabetes. You've got heart disease, as you mentioned. There is some indication that brain diseases like Alzheimer's are potentially falling into those metabolic diseases. And those have to do with the food we eat.
Yeah. And so I'm assuming that in those countries and cultures where – which is virtually everywhere else but here, all those incidents of disease are far lower. There's another cross-cultural example before we close, and I was wondering what you feel about this. Americans tend to think that kids need certain foods, like they need macaroni and cheese, and the parents
need more milk.
They need macaroni and cheese. Mm-hmm. They need these kid foods. And when I lived in India as a Peace Corps volunteer, what Indian kids ate, little kids and big kids, they ate what they ate was curries, hot curries.
What their parents
and
ate.
And nobody made special food for them. So on a closing note, what advice would you give parents about that?
Oh, feed your kid real food. I know that we don't have much time, but that's a really, really tricky one that we can talk about a little bit more when we come back, because it is a really, really good topic.
Okay.
Feeding your kids is a good one.
Don't make special food for them. Feed them healthy food that you eat.
Yeah.
Okay. We do need to wind up. And I want to thank Sarah Lewis for sharing her knowledge and personal experience concerning weight, exercise, and healthy living. And I want to thank you especially for your inspired teaching and support to people who are in the group. And as I understand, there'll be another one starting in May.
In April.
Oh,
yeah,
in
we're
April.
Looking at starting another series in April.
And I'd like to thank Shelley Delaney for being the technician tonight and for her support of the show. So thanks a lot to everybody, and thanks for tuning in tonight. Please join us for another edition of Mind Over Matter on another Monday evening next month.